So let's bring him up. It is time for the Animal Voices Show.
Welcome to Animal Voices, the weekly program that endeavors to increase compassion for all living creatures. I'd like to read you a quote from a book entitled Animals, Ethics, and Trade, edited by Jackie Taylor and Joyce DeSilva. Respect for animals is neither sentimental nor unscientific. Rather, compassion for others and resistance to using them, human or non-human, merely as a resource, is a fundamental value that underpins sustainable development in its fullest, most constructive sense. Animal Voices is presented through the cooperative efforts of Vancouver Humane Society, Earth Save Canada, and Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection. Ideas expressed on this show are not necessarily those of these three local organizations. My name is Marge Adams. In the studio with me is our technician and announcer, Alan Jensen. Co-host Carl Loskin is enjoying a much-deserved break today. On this program, we will be speaking with the Director of Farm Animal Programs for the Vancouver Humane Society, Leanne McConaughey, will be telling us about the proposition recently passed in the state of California regarding cruelty inflicted on farm animals through factory farming practices. Later, we'll be hearing an interview done by John Pranger on the subject of diabetes. Leanne will be calling in very soon, I believe she's on the line right now. Hello, Leanne, are you there?
How are you doing?
Oh, hi. Fine. Thank you for calling in very promptly.
No problem.
Now, maybe we could start by having you tell us about what the Proposition 2 involved in California.
Sure. Proposition 2 was a ballot measure that was put on the November 4th election ballot in the state of California. And essentially, the act that was brought into, that voters brought into being was the Prevention of Cruelty to Farm Animals Act. And it's a fairly moderate measure. Really what it asked for was that farm animals be able to stand up, turn around, and extend their limbs. And basically what this addresses is things like gestation crates for pigs, crates for calves, so veal crates for calves, and battery cages for egg-laying hens.
Goodness, is that all?
Yeah, it seems pretty sad that you need to pass an act just to allow an animal to turn around and it's... not touch the sides of cages or other animals, but really that's what they were asking for.
And what was the outcome of the election ballot?
Well, there was incredible support for it. They had a 63-37% majority vote, so a lot of people really felt that this was something that needed to be addressed. And one of the things that has helped the situation, certainly in California, was that leading up to the election, there was some undercover footage of abuse happening in egg farms, abuse happening in the dairy industry as well. So I think consumers began to see some of this footage that usually is kept from us most of the time on television. And farmers, the factory farms, that is, really don't want us to know what's happening.
No, I'm sure they don't. I understand that the Humane Society of the United States was a strong proponent of the bill.
Yes, they were. They really led the charge on this one and did have some support from some other groups as well. And they really took this forward, made sure that they got out to the people, talked to people about it, let them know what it stood for. And in order to even get on the ballot measure, they had to have at least 400,000 signatures to begin with.
400,000?
So, yeah,
my goodness, that would be a lot of work.
Yeah, a lot of door-to-door and things like that. And they wound up collecting about 800,000 signatures in the end. So it overwhelmingly was able to go onto the ballot, and we're just glad to see that people care enough to make a law like this come into effect?
Yes, and it's certainly increased public awareness of how bad the situation has been.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It's not going to be a whole lot better, even if everything is practiced. And I wonder, what is your thinking on that? Will it have an immediate effect on the farming practices or not?
Well, the ban, recognizing that there is investment in agriculture, and we have this situation already where the majority of eggs are produced in battery cage hens or battery cages, and I'm going to talk about the eggs specifically because what was unique about California was it was the first state to pass a law that included battery cages for hens. There was a few other states that have passed similar laws in the last year or two. Mainly those dealt with veal crates and gestation crates. So California was the first to include egg-laying hens, and that is the predominant form of agriculture in California as well. So that was very important from that perspective.
Really? That egg-laying hens, well, or chickens in general, are the predominant type of agriculture?
In the state of California.
Really?
So this sort of showed that people weren't thinking first about the economic situation that the opponents of this law certainly tried to throw out there, saying that it would devastate the industry, which is not the case. But because they recognized there was, the Humane Society and everybody else recognized there was this current investment and that, you know, 98% of all eggs are produced this way, they've given sufficient time for producers to change their operations over to free run and free range. So the actual full-on ban will take effect in 2015. But what we've seen in other countries, such as in Europe, is that once legislation is put in place and farmers know that there's a time period that they need to convert their systems over, they typically start to phase in new types of production systems. So a lot of farms in the UK have already converted into free range, and I think it's over 30-40% of all farms in the UK are already free range. So and their law doesn't take effect till 2012. So I think it just shows producers that this is what the public wants.
Yes.
And once the public knows all the other damages and problems with these kinds of operations, they see that their buying public wants them to do things differently, and they will begin to shift and adapt to that new way.
Yeah, I hope the fact that HSUS was involved wouldn't cause any people to think that, well, now it must be pretty good. Because this, you know, the HSUS is very well respected.
Absolutely.
Do you anticipate that a possibility, or is that just an imagination that people might say, well, it's not so bad anymore, I'll go back to meat eating?
It's certainly a situation that we see with some of the foods that are labeled animal welfare certified, for example, that people will say, oh, okay, well, now that I know they're having a great life, it's going to be okay to eat them. But really, it comes down to the fact that when we use animals for food, as the majority of people do, they still have slaughter and transport and other things like that where there is some suffering that occurs. This particular act in California dealt primarily with their life, their life on the farm, which is unique as well because there are some other legislative rules in place, both in Canada and the U.S., that really only cover transport and slaughter. And these came out as through the CFIA, Canadian Food Inspection Agency, those sorts of things, whereby they really were looking at the quality of the product, the food safety issues versus the animal's life. This is a law that actually looks at their life on the farm and tries to give them a more humane, or as some of us like to say, a less cruel existence. So certainly there are still there is still suffering, and because this does say that they have to at least be able to extend their wings and turn up and lie around, it doesn't mean they can be fully out of cages and fully out of confinement. They're not free to roam where they please. So depending on what your definition of cruelty and humaneness are, some people will see that this is suitable for them and they have a good conscience about eating. Others will still feel perhaps it's not enough. But the important thing is it's a start, and in the case of hens, it's getting them out of cages, and that's what we really feel is a beginning step and an important step to make.
Yes, one step at a time, perhaps, is the way it's going to go. Huh?
That's right.
Yeah. Now, I know that you're very concerned about the chicken. Well, you're doing all farm animals, concerned with all farm animals, but certainly the chicken out campaign is a major one, isn't it, with Vancouver Humane Society?
Yes, that's right. We've been working on chicken out for about 5 years now, And we focus on that one for a couple of reasons, on leg-laying hens for a couple of reasons. Number one, in Canada, there's about 26 million laying hens that are used to produce our eggs, and so there's a large number of animals there. So we look at the level of suffering and the number of animals that are suffering. Second to being that huge number is the fact that egg-laying hens live for about 18 months. 1 to 2 years is their production cycle in battery cage systems. And so it's a long time to be in a confined, restrictive cage. Other animals that we use for meat, typically slaughtered anywhere between the sort of 2 to 6 month range, depending on what type of species we're talking about. So, you know, there's certainly poultry is the largest production. I think there's 500 million chickens that are slaughtered every year for chicken meat, and then 26 million egg-laying hens that are in production. So it's the largest numbering, and that's why we at the Vancouver Humane Society have focused on this issue. And also for BC, I mean, egg production is one of our larger, and poultry production is one of our larger industries as well. We're not as heavy into, say, pig pork meat and cattle as some of the other provinces.
Yes. Do you think this passage in California will have repercussions on our provincial government, perhaps, as far as the cruelty to animals?
Well, we can always hope. It's an interesting thing because I think a lot of politicians that will wonder about whether this is something the public really want to see, or are they more concerned about the price of food, or is this even an issue for them? And I think what this points out is that this really is a trend that I hate to even use the word trend, but it is something consumers are concerned about. And we've certainly seen this in the European Union, whereby overwhelmingly some countries have fully banned the use of any new implementations of battery cages, et cetera. So it's really following what's happened overseas.
Oh, yes.
And I think having something like what's happened in California, and we've certainly been doing some work with city councils in BC here. We've got about 13 so far, including some of the large ones, Vancouver, Richmond, Whistler, Victoria, who have all opposed the use of battery cages and have adopted procurement policies for city-run food facilities that only buy cage-free, free-range eggs. So we are seeing political representatives looking at this issue and trying to address changes. And provincially, I'm just hoping that they are also listening and tuning in to what the public is saying that they want. They want to see happen.
Do you have any idea what percentage now in British Columbia or in Canada is free range? I know with the various municipalities and organizations like universities and other bodies, as well as the public at large, being more clued into this situation, how far has the movement got, you know?
Well, and we're lucky that in BC there actually is probably more free-range eggs than in some of the other provinces. Now that's in part that we have a bit more progressive situation here, but also, you know, we have a more moderate climate, so we are able to do free-range perhaps in some cases easier than some of the other provinces. And by free-range, I'm referring to allowing the hens to roam outdoors and on outdoors pasture. But I think it's really due to a lot of concerted effort that ourselves and other groups have done in British Columbia to raise awareness, bring this to the public's attention. And certainly we've benefited from the exposure that the organizations in the U.S. have highlighted. I mean, even with Proposition 2, the Humane Society was able to air programs on both the Oprah Winfrey Show and the Ellen DeGeneres Show. And so reaching a lot of people this way. And I think most people don't want to buy products that are cruelly hurting animals. They want to make a good decision. And so when the information comes to them, they then start making more conscious choices at the grocery store. So in BC, I think our numbers are more like 90% of all eggs are produced from battery cage hens. I think on the egg board statistics, they say something like 75% of all eggs in BC are specialty, but the issue with specialty is that also can include what are called omega-3 eggs, which are still hens raised in cages, and then brown eggs, which is considered a specialty item. So that's why the numbers look a little bit higher if you go to some of the egg marketing statistics. But from what we've been able to deduce and in conversations with producers, it looks like we're probably more to the 88 to 90% of him.
So the marketing people are saying that 75% are specialty, where the reality is that only about 10% are really free range, right?
That's correct, yeah. And free range, free run. And if you look at the number of producers in the province supplying organic eggs,
Now, may I just stop you for a moment, Leanne? You mentioned the word organic, and that isn't that essential in order to know that these eggs are inspected, or the hens are inspected, I suppose, that it has to be free-range organic?
What we do at the Vancouver Humane Society is of course, you know, the most humane thing you could do is to not eat eggs, of course, but we recognize the large majority of the public still wants to eat eggs, and they want to, you know, eat what's best for them. So because none of these systems have an inspection process, the only systems that do are certified organic, because you can guarantee that a third party, independent party, has gone to the farms, checked the conditions for ensuring they are meeting the welfare standards and the organic feed standards and everything else that the Certified Organic BC requires. There's another certification program, too, called the BCSPCA certification, and that provides certification around welfare issues. The farm may not be organic, but at least the welfare has been addressed. So both of those systems have an independent inspection, which will guarantee consumers that they are meeting the standards set out by those programs. Mm-hmm. The other cases where we have free-range and free-run eggs, so we refer to everything as cage-free, but there is a difference. Free run and free range, there is no inspection. It's not to say that these systems aren't good. It's not to say that, you know, that you can't trust your farmer down the street. Some are very good. Some have wonderful management practices, and some do not. It's just there's no independent assessment. So if you need that guarantee, then you're best to go with certified organic free range.
Mm-hmm, good. Now, you talked about these municipalities. I'm not really clear. Is there a bylaw in each of these municipalities that we're referring to as respecting the rights of hens?
Right.
Or is it just for their own buying purposes, like the city hall, if it has a cafeteria, it only buys free-range organic eggs, just for example, or is there a bylaw that covers the municipality?
Yeah, it's really called a resolution, and what this means is that the city council agrees to adopt a certain practice. In this case, what we have gone to city council for is to ask them, because they obviously can't dictate to everybody what they should use on this issue yet. So what they have done is they encourage local restaurants and consumers to purchase free-range eggs in their buying decisions. They provide some information to the public about the reasons why. In addition to animal welfare, you might want to consider environmental damage and also public health risk as reasons why you may want to support a more natural system, a more sustainable system. So it's partially about encouragement. It's partially about bringing attention to the issue. But really for the municipalities, the only thing that they have within their direct control are their own city-run food facilities. So this would include things like golf course cafeterias or restaurants. It would include convention centers, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So anywhere where the city has the contract in place to purchase food for that facility, they then have written into their policies to buy cage-free eggs.
Would that include public schools then?
In some cases, public schools, I think, are under the provincial legislation there. It's interesting that you bring up the schools, though, because the universities and colleges have also been an area that has been very interested in adopting ethically produced foods and other matters. There's about 12 universities across Canada who have already adopted what you would almost call a similar resolution, but for them it is a purchasing contract. And in BC, we've got UBC, SFU, BCIT, and Langara, all who have adopted cage-free eggs as the only eggs they will serve in campus facilities.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know it seems a hard way to go about it, doing it institution by institution or municipality by municipality. I guess the fact is that it's easier to deal on a more personal level to get these changes made. But I'm thinking, wouldn't it be great if the senior governments would put down legislation? Is there any hope of that?
Yeah, it's interesting because You know, we've always found that the Humane Society, one of the most effective strategies is to vote with your wallet. This is by going to people, having them drive the change. So it's really about driving demand and driving, therefore, driving supply. Hopefully with enough demand, the producers will find their way to convert their systems to more humane systems, and they will meet that market demand. That way they can come up with the rules without having to wait for long, drawn-out legislation. We've seen in the past just trying to introduce some basic animal cruelty laws that are still on the books from 1892, we finally, after 10 years, wound up getting the federal government to do some change to that cruelty law, but it was so minor. In fact, they didn't even change any of the laws per se. They just increased the fines slightly. So getting legislation through provincial and federal governments has proven in Canada to be a very difficult task. And we don't have the benefit like they do in the States of putting these kinds of public issues on ballots for each election. We might have a referendum every few years on an issue of the national constitution or something, but we don't have the opportunity for people to vote on issues of public interest. So for us, the most effective way is to go through the consumer route, make sure people know what the issues are, have them drive the demand, and then have them talk to their counselors and their elected officials. And, you know, like anything, with enough letters, politicians start to respond to what their voters are saying they will vote for.
Yes.
And, you know, if we all said we will vote for elected officials who will address this issue, we might see some change happening.
No, I'm just thinking about the election tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, actually, there is an election, though, and yes, one should clearly be looking for candidates that support ideas like this. And there are some running in the city of Vancouver here, and I'm sure that's true in other municipalities. I know there are people listening all over British Columbia to this program, in fact, and there are people in your municipality that would support these things we're talking about, so it's worth keeping in mind. I just need to mention that it's now 12:23, and you are tuned to CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio 102.7 FM.
Yeah, one of the major roadblocks we have in Canada is the fact that animals, whichever kind of animals they are, other than the human species, are property. Now, that is totally illogical in my mind, but if they were recognized as sentient beings, it could make a big difference, couldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they still are, under the law, considered property, you know, not just farm animals, but obviously dogs and cats as well, and that is something that has never changed. And obviously, for industry's reasons, they want to maintain that so that it gives them the right over their own property to do what they wish. But as I say, I think that's one of those things that we're just going to have to keep working on and bring more education. And as I say, if we can deal with the issue in the way we act, the kinds of behaviors we do in terms of what we purchase, that's a way to sort of get around this issue without having to wait for legislation, which we know would get bogged down with lobbying efforts from agricultural groups, et cetera. So we just want to make sure that the consumers are the ones that are in control here. It's usually the consumers who have the most concern, and they don't want their food produced in these ways. They want to see things done healthily and humanely and respecting the environment as well. And so I think that's important to most British Columbians, and therefore it's in our power to make the changes that we want to see in the world.
Sure. So that what people should do is what? With their wallets.
Yeah, well, what they should do is, if they choose to still eat meat and eggs and dairy products, when they go to their stores, they should purchase certified organic products. If their stores and restaurants don't carry those products, then they want to ask the store manager if they can bring in more. They want to talk to the restaurant owners and managers and say, we would like it if you could bring certified organic free-range products in. You know, a lot of chefs will even attest to the fact that these products taste better. They have a better quality, and they're more nutritious because it's the animals living in its natural system, eating its natural feed the way it's supposed to. So, you know, it's good for the animals, it's good for people, it's good for our health, and it's good for the environment. So, you know, try to be an aware and conscious consumer and make good choices, just like you would around products that are, you know, avoid products that are tested on animals, and like you wouldn't want to buy products made from children enslaved in third world countries. It's the same conscious decision making. Think about what you are doing and what impact that has on another being.
Thank you so much, Leanne. We really appreciate you being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Leanne McConaughey, Director of Farm Animal Programs for the Vancouver Humane Society. Now, Alan, could we have a little break with music?
Yes, we have the Mallard Minuet coming up. Is the Mallard Minuet. Great stuff. That's British guitarist Chris Newman from his CD Fretwork. I actually have a photograph of a mallard in front of me. Well, it's a photograph of a carving, a wonderful carving of a mallard. I was at a show last weekend called Wild Birds. It's a retrospective exhibition of two Japanese-Canadian artists celebrating the world of wild birds through wood carving and photography. And the artists are Tadya Saki, a wood carver, and Roy Hamaguchi, a photographer. And this is a dynamite show. I really, really recommend you. You'll be knocked out if you go and see it. It's in Burnaby at the Japanese-Canadian National Museum, which is in the Japanese Community Center, which is at the corner of Spurling and Kingsway in Burnaby, the corner of Spurling and Kingsway. The show is on Tuesday through Saturday until Boxing Day. And I'll just mention also that tomorrow at the Japanese Community Center is their annual craft sale and bake sale, which would be a good time to go there tomorrow. And as this show is open from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Anyway, it's great stuff. These guys are brilliant, brilliant artists. And now we have a special presentation pre-recorded, and this is two of people you would have heard of this program before, John Pranger doing the interview, and Hazel Smeltzer will be introducing this piece. And this is an interview that was done with Dr. J.J. Pippin on diabetes and research on diabetes, and you'll find... And this is a very, very interesting interview. So we'll go to that now, and that'll take up most of the rest of our show, though we'll be back with another quick announcement or two before the end of the show. But I've got it all set up. Let's go, and I think the first thing you'll hear will be Hazel.
We have a guest on the phone today, and it's Dr. Pippin. Is board certified in internal medicine, cardiovascular diseases, and nuclear cardiology. He has been on several medical school faculties, including Harvard Medical School and the Medical College of Virginia, where he was chosen cardiology professor of the year three times. He has held many clinical research and administrative leadership positions and was a director of cardiovascular medicine and medical imaging at Cooper Clinic in Dallas before joining PCRM in 2005. Dr. Pippin is the author or co-author of more than 60 articles and abstracts that have been published in leading medical journals. He also has served as an invited guest and panelist for the NIH National Human Subjects Protection Workshop, the American College of Cardiology, and the Society of Nuclear Medicine.
Hello, Dr. Pippin. Thanks for being our guest today.
Hi, how are you? Is this John?
Yes, it is.
Hi, it's good to talk with you.
Oh, and likewise with you, sir. Well, you've read the news. There's been a diabetes breakthrough. Toronto scientists have cured mice of diabetes. Now, that is really big news, and it's been all over the place. And, of course, Canadians take a great deal of pride in the fact that Canadian researchers are involved. And what with Sir Frederick Banting and his history and so on, why this is very big news. What do you think? Do you think this procedure will work in humans, or is this just another dead end?
The way I think of these stories, John, is like I think of fake news. You know the practice that sometimes government agencies or companies use where they will package information and send it to a news organization or a TV station, and they'll put it on the air as if it were news when, in fact, it's really public relations more than anything else. That's what this is. This is the scientific equivalent of fake news.
Because
the finding of curing diabetes in these mice, first of all, it may well not be that at all, because it hasn't been verified. But it has absolutely nothing that history shows us to do with accomplishing the same in humans. And I've read this story, and there are quotes here that are exactly like quotes from other scientists who have cured diabetes in mice. It's not the first time this has happened, you know. We can talk about that in a minute. But I couldn't believe it. One doctor says, mice with diabetes suddenly didn't have diabetes anymore. Another doctor says, I've never seen anything like it. In my career, this is unique. Well, I've gone through a lot of the literature on diabetes research in animals and, in fact, cures that have been found in animals. The language is always the same. The hype is always tremendous. And do we have a cure for diabetes yet? John, I'm not aware that we do.
No, but I don't think
they
so
have,
either.
They have all failed. This is a typical animal research breakthrough hype. We would love to believe it. Would love it to be true. But if you track these kinds of fantastic news stories through the course of events and actually look at the human tests down the road, almost universally, once in a while, something will lead to a significant discovery. But almost all the time, they don't work in humans. Now, I promise you something else. You won't ever see that story in the newspaper.
So what, like 95%, 96%, 97% never make it?
Well, that's for drugs that are tested. Mm-hmm. But if you look at two ways that we track these animal research breakthroughs, one is called systematic reviews, where you look at all the animal research, and then you go find the corresponding human research to see if it worked. And the other is citation analysis, where you look at these kinds of reports, and then you look at the clinical trials and see if these reports are referenced at all. In other words, did they contribute in any way to the human results? And you get similar sorts of correlations, less than 10% in most cases. So one of the things that's frustrating about trying to educate people about the futility of using animals to study human diseases is that there is no barrier to this breakthrough hype, this snake oil selling, and there is no routine follow-up to hold these scientists' feet to the flame to show that they're actually producing something. Now, you're going to make a tape of this, I presume, and you'll have an archive.
Yes.
I'm going to say, this is risky, but I'm going to say in a year or two or three, when the human testing is done, pull this tape up and see whether this was a success or a failure. The odds are overwhelming that this is going to be one more in a long line of failed cures for diabetes in rodents.
Aren't they going to start clinical trials almost immediately in the new year so that there's not even going to be testing on other species?
I don't know.
I think that's what I read in one article.
In the U.S., of course, you'd have to submit this to the FDA and get what's called an IND, Investigational New Drug Approval, so you could begin doing human testing. I don't know what the equivalent process is in Canada, but I'm hopeful that they will get that done. The sooner this translation is attempted in humans, the sooner we'll know whether this is a good result or just one more failure.
And by failure, you may include the fact that human beings will be hurt by it, or killed, or whatnot.
Well, it could be. Typically, in clinical research translations from animal research, it's done slowly and carefully enough that that you detect those kinds of problems fairly early on. But you're right. Sometimes they do sneak through even the early human trials, and it's not until these things are out in the mainstream that you begin to discover that they're killing people, like Vioxx and Regulin, which was a diabetes drug that was terrific in animals and killed hundreds of people. So, yes, sometimes it happens. Hopefully you're going to find those mistakes earlier than that.
No, I don't know. I'm just looking through that paper, that article from the National Post, and I don't see anything about the procedure that they used. It was a substance P or something that they injected into the mouse's, I think it was the pancreas, and targeting the pain receptors. Is that right?
The theory behind how people get this type 1 diabetes that is caused by failure of the pancreas to be able to produce enough insulin is that something triggers an immune response. In other words, the body's own immune cells begin to attack the cells of the pancreas that produce insulin, and they destroy those cells. And that produces diabetes. And much of the research that's been done in animals has focused on the immune system and finding ways to try to block that response. Where this is different is the researchers claim that that it's pain receptors in the pancreas, so-called nociceptors, that are responsible for this, because it's their responsibility to produce the substance that prevents that immune system attack from taking place. So the theory is, if these receptors in the pancreas are perceiving painful stimuli, that they will not produce enough of the substance that blocks the effect of the immune system. So the theory is, if you relieve that condition with this substance P or whatever, these nociceptors will then release enough of the substance to inhibit the immune system. The pancreatic cells won't die, and they'll be able to make insulin. That's the theory.
Mm-hmm. Now, in human beings, clinical clues will sometimes suggest new research, right? And then it'll be modeled in animals or something, and if it fails, well, then they'll discard it and disregard the human findings, and so the cure is thrown in the garbage. And that's the sort of procedure that happens all the time, isn't it not?
Well, sadly it is. Happen, yeah. And you know, the frustrating thing from the point of view of us who try to educate the public about this is that it happens over and over, and it's as if researchers have lost the ability to learn from their mistakes. Let me just give you a couple of examples. This is not even the first cure of diabetes in rodents this year. It's the third one.
Yeah, I got one right here that I took from the BBC. I'll just go ahead.
That's right. In February 2006, there was a report from a group at the University of Minnesota here in the States where they transferred pig pancreas cells into monkeys.
Oh, boy.
Are you following me here? And they found that they could reverse some of the changes that caused diabetes by giving pig islet cells to monkeys. Now, never mind the fact that every xenotransplantation, that is, species to species, that has been done in humans has resulted in death of the human within 18 months. Never mind that. We haven't even mastered xenotransplantation. There's not one piece of evidence in the world that this is transferable to humans. And in April 2006, but they cured monkeys of diabetes. Well, we'll see what comes of that.
Well, did the monkeys really have diabetes, or is it just
a
simulation?
They produced diabetes in the monkeys. So you cannot create human diabetes in any animal. But all of these tests that are done in animals are done in animals that are developed to mimic to the greatest extent possible the human condition. So it's always a crapshoot in terms of whether you're even talking about apples and apples. Mm-hmm. And these mice are a good example of that. I'll talk about that in a second. But in April 2006, there was a report from California, La Jolla Institute in San Diego, that by combining a monoclonal antibody and a peptide, they could cure mice of diabetes.
Wow, we're getting somewhere.
So that's two. Now, good for the Toronto scientists, but they're only the third one in 2006.
Oh, well, let me quote one, too. A cure for diabetes could be a step closer after scientists found cells from the spleen can transform into insulin-producing cells, and so they transplanted cells from healthy mice into sick mice, and lo and behold, they were able to halt and even reverse the disease in mice. So you can imagine the triumph.
Yeah. Now that research was done in 2001 and 2003, and it was done in a genetically modified mouse called a non-obese diabetic mouse, or NOD mouse, and it was done at Massachusetts General Hospital. And there are some quotes in that research that are very much like the quotes I mentioned at the beginning of this. Let me just tell you one. This is Dr. Faustman, the main researcher in that. She said, "We showed this amazing treatment could cure end-stage mice." And by that, she means mice with end-stage diabetes. And there was pretty much disbelief that you could cure end-stage mice. So this is almost a carbon copy of the very strong claims that we're seeing in this article that you're focusing on today. Well, 2 years later, three different studies came out from Harvard, from the University of Chicago, and from Washington University in St. Louis, showing it didn't work. The feeling was that by giving these spleen cells to the mice, they were acting in some regard like stem cells, and that they could differentiate into cells that would repopulate the pancreas and produce insulin. Well, three different places tried to duplicate this. Now, remember, this was the cure. This was the cure for diabetes. It didn't work. And they showed that the spleen cells, well, actually, they don't differentiate into cells that go into the pancreas. And they found that the reason the first researcher got cures is that they stopped the treatments they were using to attack the immune system that produced the diabetes in the first place. Hmm. So that didn't work. That was a cure. There's another genetic model called the STZ, or streptozotocin diabetic mouse, that has been used to find several potential treatments, none of which has used in humans. And then when they tried to figure out why, they found out that this particular strain of genetically modified mouse can live without insulin. Now, that's you and I can't live without insulin for very long. We'd be dead.
Yeah.
But this mouse can live without insulin. So everything worked. Of course it did. The mouse would have lived anyway.
So they create a monster.
And there's other models like the Zucker rat that we use to study obesity and high blood pressure and diabetes. Well, you can give the Zucker rat the clinical form of diabetes in that you can give insulin and it doesn't work, but the rat's blood sugar doesn't go up. So of course, everything you try in that rat is going to work.
Why aren't these people laughed off the stage? Instead, they get brilliant photo ops here. I see this guy standing here beaming with his discovery. He's got a test tube in his hand with the miracle potion in it.
Uh-huh.
And it's a sugar-like molecule reducing tangles in brains of laboratory animals. Well, they think they're going to curtail Alzheimer's disease. They've got Alzheimer's mice. You know,
yeah.
And then when they fail, then they go looking for more models, don't they? And in the same way and in the same place, and they never learn or teach.
Yeah, I know a couple of people who are honest animal researchers, and I'm not saying that to be derogatory, but they're animal researchers with a big overview. And they tell me that the fundamental problem is that when you are trained in this science and you truly believe in this science, you can't see that the fundamental basis is wrong. Your answer to failure is always, we need a better animal model.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is there somewhere. We have to keep looking. When they found out that the kind of mice they did all the immunological research on actually had an extra thymus gland that nobody knew about, and you wonder why the research in these animals never produces any clinical results. The response of the animal researchers wasn't, well, boy, that was pretty stupid. We shouldn't have been using a mouse that had an extra thymus gland. The response was, well, we'll have to try a different animal and do all that research all over again.
Yeah.
That's the problem with it, is the inability to see the forest for the trees and to understand that it's not the specific animal that you're using. It's the fact that it's not a human, and it won't translate. There's a real good online journal called Pelos, the Library of Science Journal, just had a review article on the translation of animal tests to human medicine. And the scientist who wrote it, who's a basic science researcher, he called the translation of animal test results to human benefit, I'm quoting now, a round-trip journey from bench to nowhere. Okay? Now, this is from an animal researcher. This realization is out there to some extent, but it is a very perplexing thing that we can't seem to climb this mountain. There is a deaf ear, and the public, I guarantee you, in Canada will respond to this with great expectations, and they will not remember this 2-3 years down the road when it fails, and there's no story in the paper about, oh, remember that big breakthrough we had? Well, it kind of wasn't really. They'll never see that story. So the impression you go away with is that all animal research results translate into human benefit.
Yeah.
The truth is virtually no animal testing results translate into human benefits, but you never see the other side of the equation.
But, and yet, as you say, the vivisectors, the animal experimenters, are well aware of the arguments against them.
Well, some of them are. Some of them never admit it. As I said, they really believe the answer is in the animal model. It is, after all, a biological system. You know, they have hearts and lungs and spleens and livers and kidneys and so on. The problem is that no matter how you modify the genes or how you add one substance or take another out, it's still in the body of a mouse or a rat or a monkey or a dog or a rabbit, and it still has to function in that environment, and you just cannot translate it to humans. Let me give you an example that ought to end this argument, but it doesn't. In so-called identical twins, human twins that are from the same egg, monozygotic twins, the general thinking has always been that genetically they are as close to identical as you can be. Same species, same egg, same genetic material from the mother and the father. What more could you ask for? Well, now there are studies showing that even identical twins will respond to treatments and drugs differently from each other because, although they have virtually the same genes, they have different triggers to turn these genes on and off. They have different hormone levels and various other things. So even in identical twin humans, you cannot use one response to predict another. And you're going to tell me that because you cured diabetes in these mice that you think this is going to work in humans and everybody's all excited about it? These guys need to get a life. There is, unless they can show somehow historically or with their own research that there is a translation of this to people, they ought to stop the hype. But the purpose of the hype is to keep the money coming.
Yeah.
This is PR. This is not science. This is PR. We'll see the science down the road, or at least, you know, those of us who keep track of it will. But the people of Canada are not likely to see if this thing blows up in human trials.
And it's going to create a bigger and bigger business. And the cruelty to human beings who now must live in a state of no cure and are slowly wasting away and dying piece by piece, that suffering is added on to the enormous suffering of the animals who have to endure all this false human, I don't know what. I don't know what to call it. Interference.
When people ask me, you know, so what? So some animals die and it doesn't work, we'll just do more animals. Say, well, you know, even if you feel that way, and shame on you if you do, but even if you feel that way, you've got to think what the human cost is. Billions of dollars of research flushing down the toilet in ways that almost never produce effective results. Years of delay in finding answers because we follow these dead ends. And not least of all, John, frankly, the cost in hope. in the hope of people who are waiting for a cure for diabetes, who are waiting for a cure for paralysis, waiting for a cure for HIV and AIDS, or waiting for treatments that will help reverse stroke symptoms. They're not happening, and the reason they're not happening is we're not doing the right kind of research. So there are many costs other than the cost to animals.
The answer, then, is banishment under criminal law, is it not?
Well, you know, the
we have to go people, soon, so please.
Okay, well, diabetes is not the only disease where this is true. Smoking and lung cancer, same thing.
Sure.
Animal tests didn't predict. HIV, AIDS, over 80 vaccines have failed in humans. Stroke, over 150 treatments. Every one has failed in humans. Spinal cord injury, every treatment has failed in humans. There are whole terrible diseases that have had decades of animal research and have had no results in humans, and the public doesn't know this. And this is not from me, by the way, John. This is information from government agencies like the FDA and NIH.
We'll have to have a longer interview next time. Thanks very much, Dr. Pippin, for being on our show.
It's great to talk with you.
Oh, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Dr. Pippin is a medical and research advisor.
That was John Pranger talking to Dr. Pippin, a researcher on diabetes, and that was introduced by Hazel Smeltzer to begin with. The time is 12:52. You are tuned to the Animal Voices show. This is CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, and around the world on cooperadio.org. Marge, what have you got?
Yeah, thank you, Alan. That was a very interesting interview.
Yeah, it was great.
Revelation, another revelation about animal testing on animals.
It's so interesting and stuff.
It really is, but so foolish, isn't it? Because it's over and over again.
All that money wasted, all those people with their hopes up, and they see all these headlines about new breakthrough in diabetes, and it never leads to anything.
Nothing. Yeah. You are listening to CFRO 102.7 on your FM dial, Animal Voices radio show. I have a beautiful poster here that I received this week from the Fur Bearer Defenders. I just want to tell you about it. Very timely. It's called The Animal's Christmas Tree. Your light is their hope. While children and adults all over the globe long for the sights and sounds of Christmas carols, sparkling winter snow, and holiday feasts, it is a deadly and terrifying time for our country's beautiful fur-bearing animals. It is trapping season. Foxes, wolves, ermines, ottos, and more will become victims of some of the most devastatingly painful and destructive devices ever invented. All so that their thick, beautiful fur can be taken from them to adorn consumer products. Beavers, Canada's national animals, will be doubly at risk. In addition to being trapped for the fur trade, many municipal governments contract trappers as a supposed quick fix to eliminate nature's unique irrigation specialists. Will the spirit of Christmas reach them? And this is from a Vancouver group. It has been in existence for over 30 years. A non-profit society working to stop fur trade cruelty. And they're asking for your help in lighting up their Christmas tree. They're out on East 17th Avenue. But if you want to look them up, you can go to www.banlegholetraps.com. We've had representatives often on our show, and they're wonderfully hardworking people. Now, one other thing I wanted to... I wonder if I have time to bring up to date the feral rabbit issue in Kelowna.
You've got a couple of minutes, sure.
Okay, well, I'll do the best I can here. Feral rabbits have been running around Kelowna City for some time, and fall, it was estimated there were at least 1,000 of them running at large. The animal welfare organization called TRAX, the Responsible Animal Care Society, offered to humanely trap and relocate the rabbits. The group has rescued more than 50 of the animals, and each one has been sterilized and placed in a foster home. Many local citizens have also been helping in capturing the animals. Early in the fall, I believe that was the time that the city of Kelowna hired a company to solve the problem, either by giving them the rabbits to rescue groups, trapping them and giving them to rescue groups, or killing them by lethal injection or shooting. Unhappily, Trax estimates between 700 and 2,000 rabbits have been killed. Last week, the Kelowna Council approved a new bylaw which makes the feeding of wild rabbits illegal. Hopefully that will be of some help to reducing the number of rabbits, but it seems it's so unfortunate that these animals have been shot and not always as quickly and easily as possible. I know there was a shocking story that I spoke about a few weeks ago on the show where a witness observed the company hired to get rid of the rabbits shooting a rabbit, and then it was not dead, flopping around on the ground, and the shooter ran over and kicked it to death. So that it's been a very bad issue, but the people in Trax have worked very hard and certainly made life a lot better for 300 of these rabbits, 350 of these rabbits. Thanks, Alan. I guess we're just about out of time,
just
aren't
about.
We?
I was just thinking, we were talking earlier to Leanne McConaughey about the factory chickens, and she said 500 million chickens are slaughtered in Canada every year. And I was just thinking, there's 30 million people in Canada, so that's about 15 chickens for every person in Canada. That's an amazing thought, that may, obviously most of the chicken would go to waste, like most of it's going to be sold, you know, for drumsticks or chicken wings or whatever. And so the average person in Canada eats more than 15 chickens a year. That's an incredible thought when you think
of it. It's amazing, isn't it? There are a lot of people who won't eat any chicken.
Yeah, so like I don't eat chicken. I don't touch it.
No, I don't either.
I decided years ago when I saw factory chickens, and all of a sudden it occurred to me, the life of these birds, what it's like. And it's not that I was turned into a vegetarian, but I was definitely turned into a non-chicken eater when I saw all these cages and these chickens just stuffed into these cages, and thousands
terrible.
Of them all at once. And I realized I can't eat these chickens anymore. Forget it, right?
No.
I might still eat some sort of animal food maybe, but I would never eat a factory animal like that again, because when you see it and think about it, and most people know that it's the case, but they just don't think about it. Anyway, Marge, you're going to have to sign off. We have to get out of here.
Okay. Well, thank you for listening, and we'd like to have you back listening once again next week at 12 noon to Animal Voices. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.